Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Welcome back. This is episode 32 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show, and I'm going back to the roots, interviewing one of my brothers back in South Africa on this one, Huntley Smith. Really cool dude, and he's got some cool stuff to share with us. As always, before we start the show, just have to remind you guys that the coupon code PODCAST will get you 10% off anything in our store at store.jiu-jitsubrotherhood.com. And also, if you're enjoying the show, please head on over to iTunes and leave a review. It's not a big thing for you guys, but it means a lot to me. And I'd really appreciate it. So if you do that for me, it would mean the world to me. So here we go, episode 32, Huntley Smith. Enjoy. Hey guys, welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show. I'm with my South African brother, Huntley Smith. He's speaking to me from Johannesburg, or if you're listening in South Africa, I should make it very clear, it's Springs that he's speaking from, or Springs. And it's a great pleasure for me to have him on the show. Huntley runs 7 academies in and around Southern Africa, and he's also the president of the South African Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation. He also has his own podcast, which is really entertaining, and it's called Thought Lab Podcast. Huntley, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, Nick, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very, very, very chuffed.
Good to have you on. The main reason that I wanted to have you on is, when did I meet you? How long ago was that?
The first time was at a seminar that we had at Gracie Baja Sunning Hill. That was the very, very first time where you actually gave me a rash vest that I still use to this day. So that was the first time. But I mean, I think in terms of us really getting to know one another, it would probably have been in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were down in South Africa and you came and you taught a seminar at my academy.
I remember. That was fun. I guess so it was 6 months ago then that I got to know you. And I remember I said to you when I left, you dropped me off at the airport, and I said that one of the things that I've realized about you after having spent that extended period of time with you, getting to know you, seeing how you interacted with people, seeing how you treated people, seeing your approach to teaching, seeing your approach to work, seeing how you looked after those people closest to you, I said that as in my estimation that you're not, you may not be a black belt in jiu-jitsu yet, but you're a black belt human being. And that's why I wanted to have you on the show, is because this show, I'm trying to have it about putting out good energy and good vibes. And I think that that's what you put out yourself.
So thank you, Nick. Such kind words, bud.
It's the truth. It's the truth. You know, one of my favorite things in life is to just, you know, when I've spent some time with a person and I leave them and I feel energized and I'm like, I've realized that's how I get my energy, is being around like-minded individuals. And I left, every time I leave either you or your brother, I leave feeling better than when I arrived. And I hope I'm not vampirically sucking your guys' energy so you guys are all drained when I go. But it's one of the true gifts of the jiu-jitsu lifestyle, is that I get to meet people like you.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think by its nature, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu has an, excuse my French, a bit of a bullshit filter. And what I mean by that is, you know, guys who do Jiu-Jitsu for as long as we have, you know, when you walk into academy, and one of two things happens. You know, you either change yourself to be in line with those guys around you, or alternatively, you leave. But at the end of the day, there are not a lot of long-term Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu practitioners who are douches. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about living this Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu lifestyle. That's exactly what it is. I mean, everybody we meet, all the guys in Johannesburg, all the guys in Cape Town, in Durban, and the guys that come and visit, just the most incredible people.
That's, yeah. I mean, I often wonder if, you know, let's say hypothetically we were doing cricket and we were living the cricket lifestyle and, you know, hanging out with guys at different cricket clubs, I wonder if you would, if it would be the same, and it's more a reflection of who we are and the attitude that we're approaching things. It means we just attract those kind of people, or we find ourselves in circumstances around generally good people, or if it is actually a function of jiu-jitsu. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's both, Nick. I definitely think that by its extension, you know, jiu-jitsu turns off your ego, which is really, really good. Simultaneously, because it's very dichotomous, simultaneously it gives you a sense of pride and a sense of security and self-esteem. So these two work on you depending on the type of individual you are, you know. And at the end of the day, I think it turns you into this great person. And if you've got a room of 20 of those people, you know, and you're constantly seeing them sort of week in and week out, it can only be good for you, you know, being in that environment. And I'm going to give you such a fascinating story. I was watching my brother play at SA on Tap, which is a big music and sort of beer festival that happens in South Africa. And I had some random guy walk up to me and sort of tap me on the shoulder. And he points to one of the beer stands and he says, "Hey, go there. You know, so I rock up to the stand and I meet this guy and he goes, "Hey, dude, you're wearing a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu t-shirt." So I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "Do you train?" So we started getting into a conversation. Turned out he was a blue belt. You know, we started chatting. We have since, he's from Durban, right? So he had come up from Durban, which is about sort of 500-600 Ks from Joburg. We just created the most incredible friendship. I've since trained at his club, met his coach. My brother, he owns a phenomenal bar in Durban called S43. And my brother's played there because I was wearing a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu t-shirt. Now, you tell me, Nick, if I was wearing a Manchester United t-shirt, do you think it would have been the same?
Wow, that's a fantastic example. That is a really fantastic example. And to the answer, yeah. I think is it's unlikely it would have been the same.
Absolutely, man. He literally put up some of my guys who were driving down to a competition, and he's like, "They're your boys. They can come and stay in my house for free."
That's great.
Yeah, that's rare awesome. In South Africa, man.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not something that happens every.
No, that's really cool. Yeah, I mean, you don't need to sell me, man. we're both living the dream. Thanks largely because jiu-jitsu is so cool. So Huntley, could you tell me, you have some interesting ideas regarding coaching. I know you're an excellent coach and I love the way you systematize your approach to running your academy and the syllabuses that you put in place. Before we even get into that, could you tell me a little bit about how you came to be training in the martial arts and in particular in jiu-jitsu?
I've got an absolute fascination with Chinese cultures and Western cultures. And my first martial arts was, of course, wushu, style called Shaolin. I did that. And it was great. It was fantastic. I mean, for the time, it made me super flexible, which was really great in later life in jiu-jitsu. But I looked at the style, you know, and I started doing it, and I really loved it, and I thought it was so phenomenal. And I watched a competition of sort of what are the best guys in the sport competing, and I saw what was supposed to be this very beautiful fluid style turn into basically Western style boxing. And I sat there and I looked at this and I thought to myself, okay, well, if that's what your body wants to naturally do, then that's what I'm going to do. So I quit that and I started boxing. And when I was younger, I absolutely loved stand up. So this was probably around about the age of 18, 19 that I started Shaolin. And then I moved on to boxing. And then from boxing, I sort of moved into Muay Thai. Because of the Shaolin, it gave me a really great propensity for legs. You know, I was super flexible and I could kick really well. And during this journey, a very good mutual friend of mine, a mutual friend of ours, Nathan Ross, who I was training with, I'm not counting in all the other styles I've done. I'm just giving you the abbreviated version. He kept on nagging me saying, "Come and check out this jiu-jitsu stuff." And, you know, I was like, "Oh, yeah, Nate, you know, whatever, dude." And he kept on hounding me. And eventually I rocked up at his club, you know. And back then he was dating a very, very beautiful, a very small brunette girl called Shuri. And he's like, "Get on the mat with my chick," you know. And I was like, "Oh, come on, Nate, dude, you know what I mean? I'm a boxer, I'm a Muay Thai boy, you know, you know what I mean? What's this chick going to do?" And he's like, no, go for it. And she completely dominated me, tapped me. And that was the start of my love affair. I mean, that's literally how it started. I got beaten by a chick.
That's great.
Of course, I'm very small. I mean, you know, I'm 74 kilograms. And I looked at this and it immediately appealed to me because of the mental aspect, the game aspect, the chess aspect, the knowledge aspect. And that's how it started. Yeah. Way back when there was probably two or three black belts in the country.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's That's something else I wanted to speak about is the growth of jiu-jitsu in a place like South Africa. I'm sure there's many people listening to the show right now who I'm sure there's many people in South Africa, but also a bunch of people in what I consider to be pretty isolated countries. I mean, a couple of weeks ago we had someone on the show from Trinidad, and he was speaking about his difficulty in growing his academy and getting all the fighting factions together. And that's something I guess I wanted to speak to you a little bit about. I can only really see the scene from when I visit an academy and teach a seminar, like when I visited your place recently, when I'm in Cape Town teaching a little bit at a club. But a lot of people say to me, "What's the scene like in South Africa?" And I don't really have an answer for them because I'm not there often enough. Like, well, what are your thoughts on how it's growing and how it's developing?
Look, it's been a very, very long road for us. Most certainly, we started off a big group of us all started off with one sort of black belt, and I mean, he's, for a lack of a better way of putting it, I'm gonna name it. I think he's the godfather of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in this country, and he's Rodney King. And he brought out Chris Howdo, who graded me to blue belt. He brought out a couple of serious guys. Matt Thornton was out. I mean, I remember going to seminars with Matt Thornton and Chris Harder. We didn't even know who these guys were. I mean, they're my heroes now, specifically Chris. It's been a long road, and initially the jiu-jitsu was very, very poor. The technique was very, very poor. Not for lack of effort, but for lack of knowledge, So for argument's sake, my coach Nathan Roths, when I was a white belt, he was a white belt. And he would go to Rodney and he would basically learn from Rodney and come back the very next day and teach us that. And in hindsight, the dedication and the commitment and the devotion of these original guys is astounding, because without this, I mean, he must have been teaching us the worst stuff, right? But I mean, this is what brought us to where we are now, there's like three Cape Town jiu-jitsu scenes, right? Bigger jiu-jitsu scenes. I might even add in a fourth, right? There's Cape Town, which has got a really strong jiu-jitsu scene. Probably the oldest club in the country is run by Kurt George, right? I mean, he's Henzo Gracie, and of course he's under John Danaher. I mean, we all know who that is. And there's a really strong jiu-jitsu scene in Cape Town. It's a lot older in Cape Town than it is in Johannesburg, right? So I would say probably the birthplace of jiu-jitsu is in Cape Town, followed by Johannesburg, of course, which has got a really, really strong jiu-jitsu scene now. And then we've got the likes of Durban, your outlying areas, such as PE. I mean, of course, Chris Bright is in PE, and Pesva is such a phenomenal club, and he's such a great black belt. In fact, you gave him his black belt. Yeah.
He's an exceptional grappler, no doubt about it.
Exceptional is an absolute understatement. So I think over the last 5 years, I mean, we've been watching this game. I was there for the first time that we had our version of albeit a little bit smaller, of the UFC, which is called the EFC, and I was at EFC 1 with Nathan, EFC 2, Nathan fought Chris, and this was really where things started changing for us. As much as I have a love-hate relationship with mixed martial arts, I hate the douchebaggery that comes with it. And the guy who walks into one club and now all of a sudden, one class, and now thinks he can fight,
Yeah, because
but it
he
has,
trains UFC.
yeah, he trains UFC, bro. Like I can do this stuff, And on the flip side though, it has been really good, because without the UFC and without the EFC and without Pride and without all of these organizations, our little obscure sport, right, would never have come to light. So with the advent of the UFC, things really started to take off in the country, and I've seen over the last 5 or 6 years how things have really come into their own. I would like to believe that technically the jiu-jitsu in South Africa is rock solid, man. It's sound. And you must understand where we come from as South Africans, right? We're very much a conflict-ridden nation, okay? And we come from conflict. It is who we are. I mean, in schools, in our history, in our past, in our pubs, there's a lot of conflict. We're tough guys, look at our rugby, look at one thing anybody would turn around and say, yeah, playing rugby against the South Africans, you're going to get a physical rugby game. You know what I mean? I've heard it said from a lot of guys who have traveled overseas, and a lot of the guys are higher level belts, that it gets said that we're fairly physical, in our jiu-jitsu approach.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I was teaching a seminar, not at your place. It might have been at your place recently. I think it was when you were away. And I was just saying to the guys how, that I literally echoed your statement, which is that we as South Africans, we've black or white or whatever color you are, you've seen a lot of shit, dude. You've seen whatever side of that you're on, you've seen some stuff, and I think it does foster or engender a certain sort of. My friend once said it. He said it's like a chutzpah. Like you're a South African.
Exactly.
You've kind of like, you've lived a pretty hard life. In one way or another. But even if you're a privileged white guy, that comes with its own difficulties in South Africa. The same way as if you're an impoverished black dude. It's this. Each side of that coin has its own difficulties. And I think that's the struggle of jiu-jitsu, like specifically the sparring, is reflects that, and that's one of the reasons why I noticed there's a few countries I visit where the people are especially excited about training jiu-jitsu and especially passionate about it. And South Africa is one of those places. Like you guys are, or us guys, I guess, or we're mad about
Yeah.
it. Like. The average student in the average academy seems a lot more committed and a lot more passionate than in the average other academy. And maybe it's because it's still relatively new and it's still relatively exciting and it's taken a while for it to filter down there all the way to the tip of Africa. That it could have
Yeah.
something to do with it. But yeah, there is something about the South African spirit and how it links with jiu-jitsu. I remember the early days. I mean, this was 1999, I think, when I started training. Maybe it was 2000. And man, like, there was you mentioned that you consider Rodney King to be the godfather of jiu-jitsu in South Africa, and I know he's played his role, but I consider Ludwig Strijdom, my first coach.
That's
Yeah,
right,
I mean
yeah.
that guy, he the way he approached he traveled to train with Hickson a couple of times in the States, if I'm not mistaken. And he'd get the odd video floating around and learn from that. And the rest of the stuff, he just had to use his own intelligence and figure out from a biomechanical standpoint what worked, because he didn't have all these techniques to work with. So he had to just go, okay, the human body moves in this way, and these are the principles of control, and how do they work practically in when an opponent's resisting. And yeah, it's I think that when you go when you restrict it in that way, you gain in others, if that makes sense. And I
Absolutely.
think that's what a
Yeah, I
lot
agree.
of the level in South Africa, it is rock solid. I think I was asking more from like the perspective of the scene, like the competition scene and the growth when it comes to numbers.
I see what you're saying. Look, it's been a challenge, most certainly. And I think the biggest problem is distances, The three biggest competition scenes is Durban, Cape Town, and Joburg. We, of course, in Johannesburg, we run and I'm president of the South African Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation, and it's run by. So this is how we put it together, Nick. It's so simple, we're all very, very tight, and all the top level guys in the country now, and a lot of the club owners and things like that. I was a white belt with them. Or they were a blue belt and I was a white belt. So we've grown up in the scene together. So our friendship and our bonds, are really, really close. And I mean, I'll give you an example, but Nathan Roth's brother, Brendan Newman, from East Rand Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, he sits on the South African Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation, and he's got a seriously competitive team, And so what we did is we got all the major and the biggest clubs together in Johannesburg, and we said, right, guys, if we put on a competition and it's just our students, we're still going to have 80 people on the mat. All right. And what we're going to do is we're going to put it on to the nth degree. We're going to try and run it like absolute rock solid. So of course, all of us go and start running it. And actually it was a Brazilian guy here from Gracie Barra Ilovo called David Aguion and Nathan Roth who first put it together. And James Sachs from Gracie Barra Sunninghill, he jumped on board and then I got involved and Ching was involved, Brandon Newman. And so we've just started building it, and now I've got Malcolm McMillan, I've got James Gemmell, and all these guys who sit on the board now. And it's quite simple. We don't take a cent, not one single iota of a cent from the money we make. All we do is we pour it back into assets. So every competition, we're buying something new, adding, buying speakers, buying, you know, paying for software, getting the best medals, trying to pay helpers. And the way we're going to grow this is exactly that. It's selfless actions, but simultaneously also understand that it isn't selfless, because if I don't have a platform for my students to go and compete and to test themselves against other guys, they're going to walk around in my club thinking they're the best. And that's a false sense of security. So how could I do that as a coach? So Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu clubs need South African Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation or any competition of any sort, as long as it's rock solid, right? And the competitions need the clubs, and it's a symbiotic relationship
That makes sense.
for us. You know, I mean, we it's difficult for us because I've got my students busy rolling in a competition, and I want to call for them, and simultaneously I'm trying to run the competition. I mean, it's a hell of a thing to do, but we all do it together, and we all work at it together, and we try. So let's say, for argument's sake, one of my guys are reffing, and his student is about to fight. Then we go, all right, don't ref. You know, we try and put aside all biases and really just try and run it as rock solidly as possible. I know there's a massive competition scene down in Cape Town. I know Kurt's involved in the UEJJF, which is absolutely fantastic. I know Durban puts on a nice little comp scene, but Durban's small, man. I mean, you were there, you did some seminars, right?
It's small.
Yeah,
I
it's
think
small.
of the thing I think of when you discuss how you guys all work together to put the competition on, it reminds me of several years ago, well, 9 years ago now, when I got my black belt, IBJJF wanted me to pay $500 for the certificate, and I still, to a degree, think that that is a bit of a piss take, as they say in England. I think that's overly expensive, and it's a bit of a cash grab. And there are certain practices of the IBJJF that I don't agree with. And what people have to remember about the IBJJF is that it's a corporation. It's not a
Yeah, it's a
national,
business.
it's a business.
Agreed.
It's not an international governing body that's looking out for the athletes.
Yeah, it's as corporate as the Federal Reserve Bank.
Exactly. You said it. However, the way it is run as a business means that there's a certain level of professionalism in their approach. And it wasn't always the case, but it is now. If you go to an IBJJF competition, it's immaculately well run, and there are excellent systems in place, and it's professional, and it is causing the growth, or it is helping to facilitate the growth of the sport. And I think what the way you guys are doing it in South Africa is banding together. Not only does it promote growth, but it's also fostering that ideal of brotherhood, because there is this weird fucking thing in jiu-jitsu. I don't know when it's gonna die, hopefully sooner rather than later. But my previous guest from a couple of weeks ago, Rondell, he was saying how on Trinidad, this little island, there's a few jiu-jitsu academies, and there's all this weird political infighting. And I've never understood that. I've never fucking seen what's the point of that. Like, okay, you're in a city, and there's, okay, let's say X 100,000 people, and there's five jiu-jitsu gyms or 10 jiu-jitsu gyms. There's generally enough for everyone. And like bad mouthing I don't even want to say competitors, because they're not your competitors, but bad mouthing your contemporaries and saying, oh, don't join his federation because they haven't trained under this guy, or blah blah blah. I mean, I think that's bullshit, man. And I think it's stunting the growth, and we need to get through that as quickly as possible. And that's why I appreciate what you guys have done. You've said, okay, we all have different coaches and different lineages, and we train in different gyms, but let's do something together. And I really respect that, man. I think that's great. And I think that anyone listening to this show, if you really do care about jiu-jitsu and you really do want it to grow, and you really are confident that you're running a good academy, and you're not terrified of having your students being taken because you're insecure, find the people around you in your community that are doing the same thing, that have their own academies and clubs, and reach out to them. And if they're like-minded, and if they're on the same vibration, you guys can work together, and you can, a rising tide will raise all ships. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. You know, the first step towards it was, about 2, 3 years ago, I put together, it was an ArtSolve initiative, which has now been taken over by SABJJF. But we put together something called Jiu Jitsu in the Park, you know, and we had in Joburg, we had one of the biggest open mats that Joburg has ever seen, you know.
Wow.
And this is the difference, dude, you know. Don't send a message, pick up a phone. So I picked up the phone and I phoned every single coach, and I know these guys, you know, and sure, I'm competition, right? At the end of the day, we're all vying for the same students, right? But it's so infinitely beyond that, and it's so bigger than just us, you know. And I said, guys, let's get together, let's do this, and it turned out to be such a great success, you know. And these are the fosterings of these things we need to go. The problem is scarcity mentality, right?
Exactly.
That's where that competition comes in. But I've got a bit of a unique approach, and sure, I can preach this and I can live it, and sometimes it's difficult. I'm not saying it's easy, but I turn around to my students straight and I say, guys, if I'm not the right coach for you, if I'm not giving you your ROI, remember, I'm a businessman, Nick, if I'm not giving you your return on investment, you're paying me money for a skill, right? Leave me. If you find somebody else who is better suited to you as a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu coach, leave me. If I'm not doing my job, leave me. It does two things. Number one, it shows that I don't have scarcity mentality, right? It allows my students to be there because they want to be there. And number three, I have to perform. Because if I don't, I've given my students permission to leave me. So this is what I'm doing on a weekly basis. How can I make the club better? What can we do? You know, putting out the best content, you know, putting out... It's difficult, man. Opening a club is a jiu-jitsu club, they said. It'll be fun, they said. Yeah.
But what you've just described about that willingness to let your students or to encourage your students to actively be making sure that you're on the cutting edge and giving good service, to me, it's one of the things I love about jiu-jitsu is that's as far to me as the guy teaching dim muck is, because he or the guy teaching some fucking arcane bullshit martial art, he's usually stuck in these rigid patterns. He's not learning, he's not progressing, but he demands this like discipline and faithfulness and loyalty from his students, and which is hysterical because he's got no right to, if you think about it. And I really respect that about you, Huntley. That's fantastic. Speaking of offering this amazing or trying to offer amazing service, I know you said you've got a new approach to coaching that I'm sure a lot of the coaches or potential coaches listening to this would appreciate. Could you share that with me?
All right. Look, it's a little bit of a thing, and I started writing it down, and we have to understand where this comes from. You know, at the end of the day, you know, my coach always says to me, whatever I'm teaching you didn't come from me. It came from multiple sources of jiu-jitsu, you know. And this idea comes from multiple people, you know. Started off with Nathan Roths, who first started coaching me. You've been, in a very short time, you're a massive, massive influence, not only on the way that I consider and approach jiu-jitsu, but techniques as well, you know. You did some really great stuff with me.
Thanks, bud.
Your podcast with Mike Bidwell, your podcast with Kit Dale. And then, of course, the work that I've been doing with my coach, Richie Kwan. So when I first approached Richie to be a coach, you know, I saw that he had something special. And not just him, but his students, man. And I'm the type of guy that I don't look at it and go, well, you know, I'm not going to have ostrich parasitic syndrome. Do you know what that is, Nick? When you put your head in the sand and you just completely refute everybody else's reality, right? So I looked at this and I was like, man, there's something special here. You know, you've met John Paul Meza, one of my coaches.
Great guy.
So John Paul Meza was training with with Richie. And man, this guy was coming back going, Hans, this jiu-jitsu is on another planet. And he was running gauntlets for us, man. I mean, he was getting smashed. He was driving there on his own. Obviously, he's got a good relationship with the guys, you know, some of their top fighters we know, and we've trained and we've coached, like Boyd Allen. And he came back to me. He was like, Hans, man, there's something special here, dude. You know, and I looked at it and I was like, okay, cool. I approached Rich and we started our relationship coaching point of view. And his foundation series, right, which he's got, which is a complete and utter foundation series, which essentially should take you from white belt right through to blue belt, was out of this world. Now, I already had a curriculum that I'd started teaching, and I was one of the few guys, Richie said to me, I was one of the few guys that had come under him that actually had his own curriculum, you know what I mean, that I developed. And it was a cyclical curriculum. So I'd do 6 months on tops and 6 months at the bottom. And it would follow the progression of the jiu-jitsu game, you know. So first and foremost, everything needs to be underpinned by a system or a foundation or a curriculum. Now, I know you had this discussion, and we're going to get into this discussion. But in order for me to dress my house, right, to decide what my fittings are going to be, before we even get there, right, we need a foundation, okay? And this foundation is to take a guy who knows absolutely nothing about jiu-jitsu and go, right, why do you need underhooks? Simple. So our first foundation is literally underhook foundation one. And what is underhooks about, you know, and building that. So that's your discussion with regards to Kittel, with regards to techniques. There has to be techniques, and I've got to be able to teach those techniques within and underpinned by this foundation or this curriculum, right? Then let's talk. So that's the first thing, right? Techniques through a system or a foundation. Then let's talk drills, right? We discussed the drilling, and I'm with you. I'm not so much into the drilling, but what we've actually done is and myself and Richie, is we've turned this foundation series into a series of warm-up drills. So instead of normal warm-ups, like running around and doing jumping jacks and bullshit like that, because God, why are you doing that in jiu-jitsu? If you want to be the fittest, go and do fit stuff. You know what I mean? So my guys will drill one of the foundations as a warm-up. So it's not a drill. So as they come in, I'll go, right, guys, underhook foundation one, drill it. So they're doing the warm-up, but they're actually doing the technique over and over and over. Now I'm creating that muscle memory. Now I'm creating that connection between what it is we're doing and where it is I'm going. All right. So then the next thing you can start doing yourself is then you can start asking yourself concepts. All right. And that's your big why. But without the techniques, the drills, and the concepts, without the techniques and the drills, the concepts are useless.
100%.
I can't teach a white belt. You know, I was listening to Kit Dale talk, and I mean, oh God, are you kidding me? I'm such a fan, and he's such an incredible human being. And I'm listening to you talk, and I'm going, yeah, guys, at a black belt level, at a brown belt level, at a purple belt level, but there's maybe 30 brown belts in the country, where I'm from. So what I'm going is, what is the best way to get a white belt in and retain him? That's my goal, is white belt retention, right? And I can't teach a concept, a massive concept, if this guy doesn't even understand why I would go for an underhook.
That makes sense.
Does it make sense?
Right? Yeah, that makes total sense.
So I love teaching in concepts, and I think that teaching in concepts is absolutely phenomenal. And I do go why, and I often go why. I mean, you were with me when we were talking about these things, and we were stringing part of my techniques with your techniques and creating these incredible things, right? But first you need your foundation, which is some sort of a curriculum. Then you drill techniques. Then you do drills, which aren't the traditional drills. They are what I refer to as warm-up drills, right? And then you start adding in the concepts. And I think that as a foundation is a pinnacle of what myself and Richie are trying very, very hard to do. I mean, if you want to listen to the podcast I did with him, it's out at the moment. And he really, we go into a lot of detail about this. But that's a great idea of where we're going. Okay, boom, right? The last thing I want to add in, and I've got a couple of points, and I mean, depending on your time, we can discuss them. But the last thing I want to add in is, I did a seminar about 4 months ago, and it was quite a complicated seminar in terms of the amount of data that I wanted to give the students, okay? But what I was actually teaching was very, very simple, and I called it the Jekyll and Hyde, right? And Jekyll being on top and Hyde being at the bottom, right? So we first did Jekyll, which is on top. And what I decided to do is I decided to take flip charts, which is why I loved what Mark Bidwell was saying in terms of using these televisions, right? But I decided to take flip charts, and I decided to draw out the entire seminar on three different flip charts, okay? Because what that allowed me to do is it allowed the guys to not worry about taking notes. It allowed the guys to not worry about where we are in the sequence of events that I was trying to build. And guess what was in there? Strong positions, weak positions, lasers, all the things you taught me, right? And I did, and I put all these flip charts up, and I sat down and I started with the seminar. And it was a basic seminar, man, beginner stuff. Why you would do certain things. So there was a lot of whys in there. There was a lot of concepts in there mixed with techniques, mixed with drills, with visual representation of what I was trying to teach. And that's the best seminar I've ever had.
Wow.
So I think the trick is to find this happy medium and this happy balance between, you know, a technique needs to be drilled.
Yeah, my friend Mark, I asked him to listen to the Kit Dale show and then give me his opinion, because by the end of that conversation, I wasn't so sure of my position. As I mentioned on the show, Kit, he did make a lot of sense, but my business partner said that he exposed some flaws in both of our arguments. In particular, when it comes to Kit's, he was saying how Kit might learn really well in this way, but not that doesn't mean everyone learns really well in that exactly. In that particular way. And for me, I've realized the more modalities that I can cover, the more learning modalities or teaching styles that I can cover, the more likely it is someone in that class of 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 people will have something stick with them. Whereas if I only go in and teach in a purely conceptual way or a purely drill way or a purely technical way, some people will pick that up and some people, it'll be great for them, but some people will get lost. So if I try to touch on all of those different modalities, then everyone gets a little something. Does that make sense?
I agree wholeheartedly. Look, first and foremost, I mean, your coaching abilities are par none. Absolutely. I mean, I've been to probably three of your seminars now five, because of the ones you had at my club as well, plus the work you've done with me. You're a phenomenal coach.
Thanks so much, Nick, buddy.
And,
I appreciate
and
that.
What you do is you do these whys and you do these epiphany moments. Now, here's a thing that I've always tried to work on, and something my dad told me many, many years ago. He said to me, when the student is ready, the master will arrive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was thinking about that the other day, funny enough.
Let's translate that into jiu-jitsu. If I understand my curriculum to the nth degree, right, I know exactly where it is I'm going, okay, and I know exactly what I'm teaching, I can start planting seeds in foundations 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. Our foundation goes right up to 8, right? Our beginner foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So at 1 and 2 and 3, I can start planting seeds for guys to start thinking about things already, okay? So, and the reason I can do that is I can do that because I know where I'm going. I'm creating questions that need to be answered later, okay?
Mm.
Then when I answer them, right, because it's an epiphany. Why? Because the answer to a question that you are burning for is an epiphany. The answer to a question that you're not asking is shit.
That's so true. That's so true.
Simple.
Yeah.
You know, so now we're taking...
Here's something that's going to blow your mind, which is it's been a big, big breakthrough for me. I think we might have discussed this that one night, the first night I arrived at your house several months ago. And that is, you know, one of my mentors, he always used to say to me, the quality of your life is directly proportional to the quality of the questions that you ask. So it's not necessarily about the answer that you find. It's what is the question you are asking, and that will determine what the output is. And so now I'm always in every aspect of my life. It's not just jiu-jitsu. I'm always trying to ask, like, for example, if I want to get into better shape, you know, then I'll start asking specific questions like, what is my ideal physique, or what is my ideal weight? Why is that my ideal weight? I'm looking for the correct question. And when I find it, I just know that's the right question to be asked. It's a weird instinct. I'm just like, yes, that is the question I need to be asking. Does this make sense?
Absolute sense. Yeah. You know, find your why.
Yeah. That's what was
exactly
the guy's name? The TED Talk.
Simon Sinek.
Yeah, that was a fantastic talk.
Yeah. His book was called Start With Why. Mm-hmm. But it's exactly what it is, you know. And I remember many, many, many years ago, right? I'll tell you such a fascinating story on this.
Mm-hmm.
Not Chris Howder. Sorry, I mentioned him earlier. I've just gone blank, man. It's been such a long day. From Straight Blast Gym. Come on, Nick.
Matt Thornton.
Matt Thornton. My apologies. Mm-hmm. Matt Thornton had a seminar and he sat down and he said, you know, he's such a philosophical person, man. He's so intelligent. And he sat down and he said, ask yourself why you do jiu-jitsu, and then ask yourself that again and again and again until eventually you find the reason that you do jiu-jitsu. Many years later, a year ago, I sit in one of my seminars and I say, guys, ask yourself why you do jiu-jitsu and ask it over and over and over again until you find the answer. And I was doing a little bit of consulting work with one of my students and busy helping him out. And he said to me, Hans, do you know that that changed my life?
Wow.
Got to be asking why, because if you don't understand why you're there in the first place, how is it that you're ever going to overcome the obstacles that you need to overcome to become a black belt?
Yeah, exactly.
But we know it.
You've got to ask yourself that why question in pretty much every aspect of your life. Yeah. And could I ask you, Hundi, what was, when you kept asking that question, you kept drilling down to the root of it, what was the answer?
I was scared.
Wow. That's a profound realization.
Why did I start jiu-jitsu? Why did I start any martial arts? I was scared, man. I was small. I live in South Africa. There was guys bigger than me. You know, I was scared.
And
has it changed?
I guess that was my next question. Has that changed? Because fear, I found that fear is probably a good short-term motivator, but as a long-term motivator, I don't know. I don't see good anything coming out of using fear as your primary motivation.
Let me give you my progression in terms of my jiu-jitsu and my goals. My first one was, and I didn't know it, but I was scared, right? And I wanted to be in a position, right, where I wasn't scared anymore, okay? And I thought I would find that through boxing, and I thought I would find it through a whole bunch of stuff. And I did, make no doubt, right? But moreover, I found it in jiu-jitsu. And then my goal was, I wanted to be a blue belt, okay? And this is the fundamental mistake that every white belt makes, right? And I tell all my guys, man, your goal is not blue belt. Your goal is purple belt, because we know that the fall off ratio at blue belt versus purple belt, it's much, much higher at blue belt. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I sat down one day and I was like, this is off the shoulder up I had, and I'd been out for 3 or 4 years, and I sat down and I thought to myself, you know what I want to be? I want to be a purple belt, because when I'm a purple belt, I'm going to be a motherfucker. Right. Okay. So that was it. I didn't care about the blue. I didn't care about anything. I wanted to be a purple belt, because I looked at these purple belts and I was like, wow, they're amazing. When I became a purple belt, I sat down and I decided to myself, I want to be a black belt, because when I'm a black belt, I'm going to be a motherfucker. Now that I'm 37 and still a brown belt, I know I'm never going to get there. Right. But now my next goal is, when I get my black belt, I'm simultaneously going to buy myself my coral belt, and I'm going to stick it up in my club, and I'm going to look at it, and I'm going to go, when I'm a coral belt one day, I'm going to be a motherfucker. Do you know what I mean? But you've got to be able to set these goals, and you've got to work within the constructs and the constraints of jiu-jitsu. And we know that blue belt is a massive fallout belt. So we've got to try and work through that. You know, I'm so scared of making my guys blue belts.
Because they're just, some of them just ditch it. Yeah.
Yep.
Interesting. Yeah. I've noticed that as well. Of some guys just, which is strange to me, because that, for me, I know, I remember getting a blue belt was just like, damn, cool. This means I'm on the right track and I want to keep going.
Now the problem is when you think when I'm a blue belt, you're like, okay, I've reached my goal. If blue belt is your goal and you get blue belt, you've reached your goal and you think you're the man. But we know that, I mean, look, there's some serious high level blue belts in South Africa. Let me not joke, right? But you're not the man yet. Right, there might be a blue belt out there who could tap me, for argument's sake. Right, he's still not the man. He's still not the guy who's been through what we've been through and coached and had the maturity behind the belts and understood what the sport is really about. And it's not about being the man, right? It's about turning other guys into the man. That's what.
That's so true. It's so true. And that goal also, I think they're very important, like the belts and goals. I think I've gone back and forth on this, but it's my current perspective that they're very, very important. But what I've realized is there is no ultimate peak. You'll get your coral belt one day, and then your goal will be to be able to beat every guy in your gym with your eyes closed or your hands behind your back or whatever.
Exactly.
And I've got a friend who's a very wealthy guy. In fact, he's been on the show, Nick Raphael, one of my earlier guests, good friend of mine. And it blew my mind. I mean, this guy, he's not a billionaire, but he's not going to want for anything for the rest of his life. He's very financially shrewd and sound and successful. And he just said to me, we were talking about business and I was telling my goals. And he just said, look, having these goals is cool, but I guarantee you when you hit them, they're not going to be enough and you're going to want to go to the next goal. And that stuck with me. That really stuck with me. I guess the takeaway lesson is to focus on the process, not the goal, because the goal will always change.
Correct. So what's interesting is what I've started referring to, and as I started writing out this program that I discussed with you the other day, is micro goals. And why micro goals? So twofold. Number one, your brain actually rewards you with dopamine, right, for every short-term goal you reach. Okay. Inherently, we're built that way because otherwise we wouldn't have survived as a species. Okay. So your brain gives you dopamine every time you reach a goal. Okay. So now, let's say for argument's sake, I'm rolling with my coach, Richie, right? And he can just smash me, right? Okay, so what's a micro goal? A micro goal is typically he always taps me from this position with that submission. Okay, my micro goal is he's not going to tap me with that submission. Or my micro goal is I'm going to try and not allow him to get into that position. So even within the role, and even while I'm getting smashed, right, I have the keyword here is intent. For every single role I have a plan, I have a goal, I have intent, and I have a micro goal. So even as a coach, I've got multiple micro goals for each one of the guys that I'm rolling with simultaneously because I know sort of know where they want to be. And this guy, I'm going to let him tap me, and that guy, I'm going to smash him, and this guy, I'm going to, you know what I mean? And so when I'm rolling lower belts, I need to work on my game, right, through the micro goal. And simultaneously, when I'm rolling higher belts, I need to work on their game and my expectation of their game through micro goals. So then even when I'm getting smashed, guess what? I'm still getting dopamine. I'm still getting, yes, you reached your goal. You know, okay, sometimes you don't. Sometimes I try and allow Richie not to get into positions and he just makes me look like I'm a white belt. But it's so important to have these micro goals, and it's so important to have intent behind your roles, because otherwise it's just a role.
That makes total sense to me.
Just a role is cool when you flow rolling. And you know how much I love flow rolling. Okay. So in my club, we'll always start with a flow roll, right? 20%, no submissions, no lockdowns. And it's just flow. Close your eyes. Sometimes I literally make everybody close their eyes and I have three coaches walking around so nobody kills each other, right? Because I just want you to move. By the end of the class, we're going full balls, man. And then you need to have intent.
That makes total sense to me. I work a lot with to-do lists, not specifically for jiu-jitsu, but for
for life.
business and yeah, for life. And one of the things I've noticed is every time, yeah, I take great pleasure in checking things off the to-do list. And the interesting thing is, if something has been placed on a list, specifically if it's been written out on a written physical pen and or pencil and paper list, it is much more likely that I'm going to do that thing. I've got lists that of like very lofty goals that I'd written down years ago, and found those
You'd
lists years
achieve
later
them.
and seen I'd achieve them. On a more current scale now, I thoroughly enjoy crossing things off the list. It's the weirdest thing. Like an old school pen and paper, I write down my list of things for the week, and then as I accomplish them, I tick it off. And
Cross it
it's
off.
yeah, it's a great pleasure.
As advanced as I am with technology, and I love technology, Chris, Nick,
Nick,
I do exactly the same thing, man. Sorry, but I
yeah.
cross off things because you know why, right? Because you get addicted to success. I teach goal
100%.
setting as part of my consulting, and I say to the guys, tick off, man, put that green. So drop an Excel spreadsheet, and every single day you do it, do a green. Because why? You forget that what you're actually trying to achieve, and what you actually do is you start getting addicted to putting the green. Yes, I did it. Yes, I did it. Yes, I did it. And that's a way of hacking our mind, because the subconscious brain, whether we like it or not, regardless of which way we go, our subconscious brain is going to form habits, and I'll take away the word habits and say addictions. So the only real choice we have is what addictions we're going to make, because we're going to make addictions.
Yeah, they're
Okay.
going to be good or positive ones or negative ones.
Irrelevant. And your subconscious brain also does not know the difference between real life and what's in your head and good and bad. I mean, your subconscious brain doesn't know the difference between dopamine and for argument's sake, heroin.
Yeah,
Okay. It's
but your
still
body
just
knows
an
the
addiction.
difference. It knows the difference between addiction to whiskey and addiction to yoga. Like,
Your body does most certainly,
yeah.
but your brain doesn't.
That's
And all
true.
your brain wants to do is your brain wants to form addictions. That's what it wants to do.
Yeah, I never thought
And
about it that way.
well, physiologically, we built that way because, I mean, think about it, Nick. You're going to get up in the morning, you're going to drive to a club, right? A jiu-jitsu club. And if you've done this for the last year, you're going to get to that jiu-jitsu club and you turn around and go, God, how did I even get here? Like, I don't even understand, you know, like, why? your subconscious brain basically took over the process and mechanized it, made it mechanical. And your brain does this intentionally. It does it to allow you to focus consciously on other things. So whatever your brain can, your subconscious brain can mechanize for you, that's what it's going to do. It's going to mechanize it for you.
And I guess that's one of the things I was trying to get through to Kit is, once you've, he was speaking about how you don't want to become mechanical and you want to be organic, but I want certain things to be mechanized. I want to be able to do certain things as a reflex so that my mind can start thinking about solving other problems within a jiu-jitsu context. And that's one of the reasons I think that drilling particular movements is absolutely vital.
And I'm in agreement with you there, Nick. I really am, wholeheartedly. I believe those drills are vitally important. Take a white belt, right, and just show him a simple underhook drill, right, and show that to him over and over and over again. And he's going to pick it up. Explain it to him. It's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, so true, so true. Huntley, my man, you're the kind of guy I could talk to for 3 hours straight, and I have spoken to for 3 hours straight. I remember the first night I arrived at your house, we stayed away till like 2 a.m. just having a long conversation. But this is my fourth podcast of the day, and I can feel my brain is starting to say that it needs a bit of a break. It wants to engage in some of its other addictions. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show, and you're definitely going to be a guest in the future.
Thank you, Nick.
But in the meanwhile, if people want to find out more about you and your academy and what you're doing, where should they go?
Okay. So I've obviously got my podcast that we've recently launched, and you even helped me a bit with. It's called the Thought Lab Podcast. It's available on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, and the website, which is thought-lab.co.za. And my academy is ArtSuave, ArtSuave, ArtSuave.co.za. I'm on Facebook as well, man, Huntley Smith. So yeah, lots of ways, LinkedIn, I do social media, so that's what you do.
Great.
And thank you so much for having me, Nick. It's been an absolute pleasure. A couple of years ago, we're all the South African boys, so we all knew who you were, watched the videos, and always wanted to get to know you. And let alone know you. Now I get to be on your podcast. What a pleasure.
It's amazing. Yeah, the pleasure is all mine. Okay, my brother, peace out.
Dude, have a great evening. Ciao.
It's clear that Huntley is a very passionate individual. And one of the things that was immediately apparent to me when I met him was that he is committed to excellence. So he will never do anything by half measures. And I really appreciate that, because it's something that I really try to do in my life as well. I don't ever want to be known as someone who does something half-assed. The thing that became clear to me, I don't want to say it became clear to me, I knew it already, but that Huntley reminded me of, was how, there's this thing in jiu-jitsu whereby you assume that just because someone is a very good fighter or has won some competitions or has a specific belt, that they must be this amazing teacher. And it's definitely not always the case. It can be, but it's not always the case. Huntley hasn't won any world championships. He's not even a black belt, but I am almost certain that he would teach a better class than a large proportion of jiu-jitsu instructors out there. Not all of them. There's some amazing instructors out there, but there's some very average ones too. And because he's so committed to excellence and he puts so much thought into what he's doing and he works harder and he challenges himself, the quality of his classes and subsequently the quality of his students and the quality of his jiu-jitsu is excellent. And I think there's a lesson in that for all of us, like it's that constant drive, that constant pushing to be the best that you can be and create something exceptional. And I'm so, so happy to be around people like that and to know people like that and to be able to share them with you guys. Okay, guys, hope you enjoyed the show. More coming next week. Enjoy.